Today's Science Friday podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code SCIENCE at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Gene therapy has been one of those promising technologies that seems just over the horizon, not quite ready for prime time. The idea of swapping a bad copy of a gene for a functional version has been around for 3 decades. And this week, Spark Therapeutics announced positive results from a phase 3 trial for a gene therapy that could treat a congenital form of blindness. If it is approved by the FDA, the treatment could be the first gene therapy on the market. Is gene therapy finally ready for prime time? Let's talk about it. Our number is 844-724-8255. Let me bring on my guests. Richard Jude Samulski is the director of the Gene Therapy Group at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And Catherine High is the president and chief scientific officer at Spark Therapeutics, based in Philadelphia. Welcome, both of you, to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Dr. High, the last time we spoke with you was way back in 2009. You were in the early stages of your work. Can you bring us up to date on how this treatment works?
Well, that's right, Ira. And what I had talked about then was a study where in our research group, we had injected the first eye of individuals with this rare form of congenital blindness and shown that the injection of the vector AAV expressing the enzyme that they're missing worked to restore functional vision that we measured on a mobility test where people walk through a series of obstacles set up in a room in the hospital, and that test is done at a variety of different light levels. Mm-hmm. So we went on to do a second study where the opposite eye was also injected, and we showed that that was safe and also resulted in restoration of vision. So the study we've just completed is what's called a phase 3 study or a pivotal study. It was a randomized controlled trial in which people with this condition who met all the enrollment criteria were randomized either to be injected in both eyes or to be in a control group where they went through all the same series of testing but without receiving the injection. And then at the end of 1 year, we compared the results in the intervention group to the results in the control group, and it showed that two-thirds of the people exposed to the product who were injected with the vector reached the maximum possible benefit. They were able to pass the mobility test at the lowest light level where we run it, which is equivalent to the level of lighting that you see with a nightlight in your bathroom.
That's pretty good.
Whereas nobody in the control group was able to do that.
And do you know how long this effect lasts?
Well, the phase 3 study reported observations over a period of 1 year. The earlier study that was conducted before the phase 3 study began, we have longer-term data on. We have reported at one of the previous vision meetings that we're seeing durability out to 2 to 4 years with observation ongoing. And tomorrow at the meeting of the Retina Society in Paris, we'll provide additional information about durability.
And do you expect that the FDA will give you approval?
Well, of course, only the FDA can answer that question. So I think that the trial results are very exciting. Approval of any drug by the FDA involves more than just the clinical trial results. It involves the manufacturer being able to demonstrate that they can produce the material in a consistent way, produce safe, pure, potent material. It involves careful examination of all experiments that have been done in animals to support the safety of the product. So lots of things go into the FDA's decision, not just the clinical trial results, but obviously this is an important step.
Dr. Samulski, you were not part of this trial, but you have spent your career developing these viral delivery systems where you put the virus carries it in to the cells. How does this open the door for other gene therapy trials?
Well, it's very interesting, and first let me acknowledge that I was part of a very cutting-edge group of scientists at the University of Florida in the late 70s, early 80s, that developed the vectors that Dr. High is just describing that are being used to treat these ocular degeneration disorders. And the community has looked at this and began to realize that it's being tested in essentially every tissue and disease that you could imagine. There's been a number of patients that had AAV gene delivery in the brain, the heart, the muscle, the liver, the eye. And so I think what we're seeing is the beginning of an onslaught of this technology starting to march into the clinic.
Why has it been so long and so hard a road to get gene therapy to work?
Well, there are a number of factors that influence that. One is it's been primarily done all at the academic level, and so you have researchers that are taking investigational-type drugs and developing them into experimental testing that goes into patients. That's been a transition where I'm trained as a molecular virologist. We now have a GMP facility to make clinical-grade material for studies like this. And that took time to put those things in place. In addition, what you're seeing is a marriage between basic science at the molecular virology level with that of animal models that study diseases, with that of clinical researchers that have patients that they've been following for years. And the combination of that really means you have to put a consortium of investigators together to actually bring one of these to fruition.
Dr. High, there have been a few other trials targeting the eye. Why is the eye a good place for gene therapy treatments?
Well, I think the eye is a particularly good place because, I mean, for a number of reasons, but one is that, as Dr. Samulski pointed out, this vector has been engineered from a naturally occurring virus, and so in some target tissues you can have immune responses to this recombinant virion, which is not really a virus, but it can look like a virus to the immune system. So you have to understand the responses of the human immune system so that you can manage them. But in the subretinal space, in the back of the eye where the retina is, you essentially get a free pass from the immune system because it's an immunoprivileged site. A couple of other features that are good about the eye, it's a very small closed space, so you don't need a lot of vector, and you can deliver it with a needle to exactly the place where it needs to go.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Samulski, you're researching gene therapy on Duchenne muscular dystrophy, the disease Jerry Lewis spent so many years raising money for. Could this same model work to treat that condition?
Oh, yes. In fact, that is the effort that's been started some 20 years now with my colleague, Dr. Zhao Zhao. And similar to Gene Bennett and Al McGuire, who have spent the last 20 years working on gene delivery to the eye, Dr. Zhao has spent a majority of his time trying to come up with vectors that you can add systemically, meaning an IV, and get it to spread throughout the body and deliver the gene that's missing in dystrophin patients. In his case, he's been able to cure mice that had the disease, and he's actually been able to show demonstration in a dystrophic dog that he's corrected that's now out 7 years. And similar to the eye studies, I think at the research level, the data that Gene Bennett and the University of Florida and Cornell generated in the dogs, where they showed they could correct blindness now out over 10 years, it was a clear signal that if we could reproduce those technical steps in the human, we would get the outcome that Kathy's describing today and excitement around this phase 3 study. in the case of the DMD, we're getting ready to go into a phase one study to look at the similar observations that have been done with the eye studies, but in this case, obviously, we're measuring muscle strength testing instead of ocular vision improvement.
So you're ready to start gene therapy tests in the phase one on people for muscular dystrophy?
Yeah, our timeline is probably within 2017. We'll introduce this into patients. We're obviously collaborating with a number of groups. The Genethon AFM constituency in France is helping us, as well as the Muscular Dystrophy Association here in the U.S. It's an exciting time, I think, across the field for a number of us who have been in it for an extensive period of time, like Dr. High, myself, and others. We're beginning to see the early validation of what was demonstrated numerous times in the animal models.
Just a quick comment. You know, one-time treatments is usually not the business model of big drug companies. They like to have chronic illnesses so they can make a lot of money on their drugs. Where will the funding come from to develop these treatments?
Well, if you're asking me, I think it's a new paradigm. I think it's an interesting opportunity for not only the medical profession but the pharmaceutical industry to begin to look at how we move forward with this type of technology. It's not completely foreign. If you look at people who do pacemakers, one-time implants and stuff like that, and replacement of joints, there are working models out there which the industry has developed. It's a little bit atypical of taking a pill for the rest of your life. But if you think about the amount of individuals that have genetic disorders today, it's been estimated if you put everybody who has a genetic disease, an orphan genetic disease, into one country, it would be the third largest country on the planet. And that's a medical burden that I think we've ignored for a period of time, and basically it's something we can address with this type of technology.
Well, it sounds very exciting. I want to thank both of you and wish you both very good luck. Richard Jude Samulski, Director of Gene Therapy, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Catherine High, President and Chief Scientific Officer at Spark Therapeutics, based in Philadelphia. Good luck to both of you. After the break, we'll talk with Sherry Turkle about regaining the power of face-to-face conversations. Oh, do you have any more? Or does that exist anymore in the age of smartphones, texting, and social media? We'll get Sherry Turkle's view right after this break. Support for this podcast comes from Universal Pictures presenting Steve Jobs. What interests you about Steve Jobs? I found him fascinating because he followed his own dream. And now the Academy Award-winning director of Slumdog Millionaire, Danny Boyle, and the Academy Award-winning screenwriter of The Social Network, Aaron Sorkin, have teamed up and made a definitive movie about Steve Jobs called, appropriately enough, Steve Jobs. It stars Michael Fassbender as Steve Jobs with Kate Winslet, Seth Rogen, and Jeff Daniels in select theaters starting October 9th and everywhere October 16th. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. How long can you go without checking your email on your cell phone? At a meeting, do you text your friends while the boss is talking? According to a Pew Research study, 2/3 of cell phone users check their phones for messages, alerts, or calls even when the phone isn't ringing. A whole generation of kids has grown up not knowing what life is like without being attached, literally, to the smartphone. My next guest has been studying our relationship with technology for 3 decades, and she writes that in this age of total connectivity, we have abandoned the art of face-to-face conversation, and that's not necessarily a good thing. Sherry Turkle is professor of the Social Studies of Science at MIT. She's also a psychologist and author of the new book, Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. Welcome back to Science Friday.
I'm delighted to be here.
Nice to have you. You said that people would rather text than talk, and I think we see that all over the place. I mean, what is going on here?
Well, it's as though our phones make us 3 promises, like gifts of a benevolent genie, that we'll never have to be alone, that we'll always be heard, and that we can put our attention wherever we want to be. And with that, a kind of promise that we'll never have to be bored. And these gifts, these promises are so seductive that we accept them and go to our phones, and we're only now recognizing the cost because we go to our phones really in the presence of other people, and in doing so, we break off conversations.
And what is so valuable about a face-to-face conversation?
Well, in face-to-face conversation of the sort where you let a tangent develop, you let it be spontaneous, where, you know, you don't edit yourself, you let yourself be vulnerable, these are the kinds of conversations in which empathy is born, collaboration happens, in which close connection happens.
Can't these little pieces of communication add up to a bigger conversation?
Well, you know, it was Stephen Colbert who asked me if little sips of conversation on the phone don't add up to one big gulp of conversation. And actually, they don't, because little sips are good on text. It's fun. It's sexy. It's erotic. I mean, you can say, I love you, or it can be lovely,
mm-hmm.
but for a sustained collaboration, for a sustained, you know, really empathic connection with someone, you know, you need to be there. You need to be there, sensitive to when people, for example, when people pause, when people are not editing themselves, and you see the lull in a conversation. And the people I interviewed, when I talked about, you know, conversation, and how come they didn't like it, they would say things like, conversation, I'll tell you what's wrong with conversation. It takes place in real time, and you never know what you're going to say next. You know, I mean, they like the idea of being able to edit and mm-hmm. be perfect to the other person. And if you're being perfect to another person, well, that's not you. You know, you need to be able to be vulnerable to another person, not be perfect to another person.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. 844-724-8255 is our number. You can also tweet us at SciFry, SciFri. So are we raising a whole generation of kids that don't know how to speak or don't want to or care to speak face-to-face with each other?
I think we're raising a generation that find it a challenge. I mean, my students tell me that they want to email me and not come into office hours. And this is a national problem. It's not just my students. And when you ask them why, they tell you that if they send you an email, they can ask you exactly the perfect question, and you can email them back, you know, the perfect answer. There's this model that they'll be perfect and you'll be perfect. So it's a transactional model of what's supposed to happen in a conversation.
Yeah.
But in fact, anyone who's learned to love knowledge from a professor knows that it's not because anybody mailed you the perfect answer to a perfect question. It's because they took an interest in you. They showed patience with you. They let you ask a stupid question and said, you're interesting anyway, let's talk.
You know, the whole idea of conversation is to bat around ideas and not be afraid of being wrong or making a mistake. And this is exactly what the kids don't want to do.
Exactly. I think that what I found in my research for Reclaiming Conversation was this preoccupation with perfection and with the notion of editing that really is the antithesis of what happens in the kind of conversation where you let ideas evolve. It's bad for science, and it's bad for empathy, and it's bad for science.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones, 844-724-8255. Stitch in San Antonio. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, sir. Man, it is so great to hear someone speaking about this because I'm a musician at night, and I work for a locksmith during the day, and you would not believe, it's not just children, it's not just kids. I have to call my clients and let them know I'm on my way to change a tire or deliver gas. You will not believe how many times I will call someone to just, you know, let them know I'm on my way. I will get a text message back that says, who is this? Really? You can't answer your phone and have a conversation and say, hey, you know, yeah, I'm expecting your call. I don't understand it. Even when I delivered pizzas, I would get the same response. Like, people don't want a conversation. It's terrible. I prefer face-to-face or talk over the phone any day. And I don't understand why the technology is killing us like that. It's desensitizing the human race, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Sherry.
Well, it's interesting. In a recent Pew study, and the Pew is a group that tracks America's digital habits, 89% of adults said in their last interaction, face-to-face interaction, they had pulled out a phone, and 82% that said that it had deteriorated the quality of the conversation. So we're doing something that we know is hurting us.
Hmm.
And I guess I'm optimistic, because I think that, as your caller is saying, I think we're beginning to sense that it is hurting us and that it's time to make the corrections.
But you have kids are young enough that they've lived their whole lives with cell phones. They don't know what it's like not to have it and what they might be missing if they don't have it, do they?
That's true. I mean, you see scary statistics. I mean, there's a 40% decline in empathy over the past 20 years in college students, and that's what one study found. And that most of it over the past 10 years, and which has been associated with phones. But there's also an amazing piece of work that shows that in only 5 days at a summer camp that's device-free, those empathy levels start to come back up. So I think that as people begin to sense this is a problem, and I see that, I mean, part of what I found in my research that was so encouraging is that people are beginning to sense this is a problem, that we have the means of a solution when we begin to talk to each other. I say conversation is the talking cure. So I think that I found a lot of members of the younger generation complaining about their parents and how their parents were the ones who would not give them attention because their parents were preoccupied with their phones, and that they wanted to raise children, you know, in where everybody wasn't on a phone during mm-hmm. breakfast and dinner. So I think that we're sort of at a turning point. I think of it as a kind of silent spring moment, this time not about an assault on our environment, but about an assault on empathy.
Mm-hmm. In case you just joined us, we're talking with Sherry Turkle, author of Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. It's a really well-written and an interesting book. And I can see from what you're writing that you had to immerse yourself in all of this, even going to hanging out with groups of kids and watching them chatting in the same room to one another. That's how they decided that they would communicate.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I did that was very interesting is, watching how the new way of talking is to be together, but also be on your phones with each other. And one group of kids who would explain to me what the new dinner table etiquette called it the rule of three. And what the rule of three does means that when you're at dinner, let's say with six people, and of course you want to have your phone with you, you don't give yourself permission to look down at your phone until three people have their heads up and are partaking in the conversation. So what this means is that a conversation of some sort continues, but with people, you know, looking down at their phones, looking up, if they're, you know, looking down, mm-hmm. looking up in a kind of round robin. And what this does is that the conversation is kept light and on topics where people feel they can move in and out of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that people really never get to the heart of things and never feel in close connection with each other. It's like a classic study that was done where you put a phone on the table between two people, and the mere presence of a silenced phone means that the conversation is kept on trivial subjects and people don't feel a sense of connection with each other. And that's really the problem. The problem is not our phones. It's having our phones all the time at moments when we need to give each other our full attention.
Is there a cure to this disease, doctor? I mean, you know.
Yes, there is. It's the talking cure. It's putting away your phone at times when it's time to talk to people. So when you have baby bouncers for children that have a slot for a tablet, that's not a good idea. That's a moment when your child is in a baby bouncer, that's a time for you to be making eye contact and talking to your kid. Potty trainers with a slot for a tablet, not a good idea. Mm-hmm. I talked to one dad who talked about his time with his now 11-year-old when she was taking a bath, and he used to talk to her and play with her and play with her toys. And now with his 2-year-old, he sits and does his email while she's playing in the bath. Not a good idea. It's time for us to reclaim the conversation with our children and with each other. Make sacred spaces in your home, the kitchen, the dining room, the car, and make these places the time for conversation.
Have to be proactive.
Very proactive.
Sherry, talking with Sherry Turkle, author of Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in the Digital Age. Let's go to the phones. Stephanie in Ann Arbor. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm the one that suffers from social anxiety and has from the time I was a young age. And, you know, I'd be curious to get your thoughts about, you know, kind of to be devil's advocate, and the use of social media and digital, you know, communication as a means of opening up a way for those with anxiety disorder or agoraphobia, you know, to be able to communicate with the outside world. I mean, I have a number of friends, we joke about how, you know, the ability to order pizza online has completely revolutionized our lives so that we don't have to talk to someone on the phone. You know, my young son who, you know, suffers from panic disorder, you know, the fact he can use his iPod to chat with friends where the telephone would be, you know, extremely nerve-wracking. I'd be curious to get your thoughts. I can take it.
Let me remind everybody first that I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm talking with Sherry Turkle, Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. Sherry, what's your response?
I think that's great. I think that when we use our phones to make our transition to the social world easier, that's a wonderful thing. And if using social media for you is a way to broaden your experience, I'm completely for that. I think that for the larger number of people, you have to worry that using your phone potentially can narrow your world down. I'm not concerned when social media opens out people's worlds. I'm concerned when social media closes your world down. And when I see there's an amazing study of fast food restaurants done by a Boston pediatrician, and who did study, let's say, 50, it was like a study of like over 50 parents and their kids in a fast food restaurant. And something like, you know, 45 of those parent-child couplings, the kid could not get the parent or the caretaker who had taken them to the restaurant to talk to them. And the children become increasingly upset and anxious, and kind of they get, you know, they start to misbehave, and then they get loud, and then they get seductive, and then they finally just, you know, sit there, you know, silent and depressed. So, you know, I'm not my plea is for using your phone with intention. And when your intention is to use your phone to open out your world and to open it to conversation, that's great. It's more that when you see it closing down conversation, mm-hmm. that you take it as a wake-up call.
When people say they're addicted to their phones, the point I think you were making in your book is that it's that their phones allow them to avoid things they don't want. Is that?
Yes.
So
and I'm also Yeah,
go ahead.
No, I'm also concerned about the use of the word addiction, because because it also can be a cop out. I mean, if you're addicted to heroin, you have one choice. It's going to kill you. You have to throw away the heroin. It can't be a part of your life. Our phones are a part of our life. Digital technology is a part of our life. And a much more sensible way to see it is in terms of technological affordance, what the technology offers us, and human vulnerability. You know, we are very vulnerable to what our phones offer us. And the point is to design around our vulnerability. if you know that you are vulnerable to the temptation to read your mail when you're giving your 2-year-old a bath, it makes sense not to go into the bathroom with the phone. If you're tempted to read your mail during breakfast with your family, your kitchen should be a device-free zone, because those family dinners, those family breakfasts, that's a crucial time for your family to become knitted together as a group. So I think it makes sense to face our vulnerability and take account of what's really important to us. I mean, my favorite line in my book, I mean, it's kind of author's choice, you know, is that technology forces us to confront our human values, which is a good thing, because it gets us to figure out what they are.
All right. We have to take a break. We'll come back and talk lots more with Sherry Turkle. Reclaiming Conversation is the book, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. Hey there, podcast listeners. Ira here. Just a reminder that Science Friday is dependent on audience donations. So if you haven't made a contribution this year, please do so by going to sciencefriday.com/donate. Any amount helps. And thanks. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the power of in-person conversation in the age of technology. My guest is Sherry Turkle, professor of social studies of science at MIT. She's author of the new book, Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. Sherry, kids are getting smartphones in middle school. How does this affect how they interact with each other at school?
Well, I've been asked to consult to a few middle schools, and the reason I was brought in had to do with the way in which teachers are concerned with students not being able to put themselves in the place of other students. Again, the empathy gap showing up among very young students. One teacher put it that 12-year-olds are playing on the playground as though they were 8-year-olds. And when they brought in to teachers' offices, you know, when teachers ask students, well, why are you being so cruel? Or what seems like cruelty, excluding children, being hurtful to children, the children don't seem to be able to put themselves in the place of the other. And what the teachers are thinking, and I've spoken to so many teachers and so many educators and psychologists about this, is that the kids really aren't talking face-to-face. In the lunchroom, for example, when you watch them, they're showing each other what's on their phones. The phones become a sort of mediator rather than having face-to-face conversation. So it's a little bit like the difference between an apology, where I get to see that you're hurt and you get to see that I'm sorry. And that's how the healing can kind of begin, because we each get to put each other in the place of the other. And my typing out, I'm sorry, and hitting send, where nothing happens, no empathic connection can happen. And children aren't learning they're typing I'm sorry and hitting send. They're not having that experience of apology. So in the middle school is really one of the times that is a key time for the development of empathy, and it's a key time when that isn't happening.
As a psychologist, do you have any idea where or how all of this will manifest itself as kids grow up into full adults, what this effect will have on them?
I think it's going to be hard to form relationships in which you have to put yourself in the place of the other. Again, what we're facing is a crisis in empathy and a need to use conversation as the talking cue. I mean, use ways to get back to a capacity for empathy. One other thing that's happening that's very important is that kids are not developing a capacity for solitude. You know, one study of college students actually showed that after 6 minutes, college students would rather administer electroshocks to themselves rather than sit alone with their thoughts. quietly without a device. Mm-hmm. Very shocking, a very shocking study. Now, the capacity for solitude is very important because, you know, if we don't teach our children to be alone, they'll only know how to be lonely. If we don't know how to gather ourselves and be content in ourselves, we can't hear another person and recognize another person because we need that person to be saying what we need them to be saying in order for us to feel whole. We really can't develop a sort of true relationship of mutuality. So reclaiming conversation begins with the experience of solitude. And our phones, the constant stimulation of always being able to go to a screen for a constant steady feed, means that you don't need to develop that capacity for solitude. You always have someplace to go.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. We've run out of time, Sherry. It's a fascinating book. It's a great read. Sherry Turkle, professor of social studies of science at MIT. The name of the book is Reclaiming Conversation, The Power of Talk in a Digital Age. And thank you for talking with us on the great talking medium of radio that we like
thank
so much,
you.
Sherry. Good luck with the book. There's a tiny museum in Pittsburgh, wedged in between an apartment building and a pizza joint. And at first glance, it looks like a natural history museum. There are stuffed animals and dioramas, but the things on display are not your usual specimens. Instead, there's a stuffed alcoholic rat, a transgenic tree leaf, and, of course, your average fish that glow in the dark. Welcome to the Center for Post-Natural History, where visitors come face-to-face with the organisms we humans create through breeding or genetic engineering. And last week, Sci-Fi producers Annie Minoff and Christopher Intagliata got a tour of the museum from volunteer Penny Lane, and they sent us this postcard.
The Center for Post-Natural History is the only museum in the world that is dedicated to the study and the presentation of living organisms that have been heritably and genetically altered by humankind. It's kind of like this hall of curiosities, and you can kind of just wander and spend time with any of these exhibits here.
Welcome to the Center for Post-Natural History.
So this is Freckles. She's the only biosteel goat on display anywhere in the world.
Plants and animals in captivity.
She was bioengineered to produce spider silk protein in her milk. So pretty much like if you get one photo from the Center for Post-Natural History, it's with Freckles, usually.
...form and function of the living world in surprising ways.
And then behind this black curtain is the Hall of Post-Natural History. That's the permanent collection. I really like the specimen vault. Each of these little guys has a story. So like here is an alcoholic rat.
This particular rat was bred by Finland's National Public Health Institute to embody one of their nation's most prevalent public health concerns, alcoholism.
But I also really like these bulldog skulls over time and like how we created that like weird underbite thing that we decided we liked, the English bulldog. I mean, I don't know why we wanted a dog with an underbite. Like that, there's no reason. It's not rational. Like Roundup Ready corn is a rational product. But most of what I see in here is a lot more about aesthetics and desire and dreams and, you know, things that maybe are harder to explain. Like the glow-in-the-dark fish. Like we didn't have to have glow-in-the-dark fish, but now we do. I love these fish. I feed them every day.
That was museum volunteer Penny Lane showing our sci-fi producers around the Center for Post-Natural History in Pittsburgh. You might have heard a voice there, someone's taking us on that recorded tour, and that was Richard Pell. He is founder of the Center for Post-Natural History and associate professor of art at Carnegie Mellon. Welcome to Science Friday, Rich.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
We'll get to Freckles the goat in a second. Let's talk about first, why do we need a post-natural history museum?
Yeah, well, the idea really came from visiting a lot of natural history museums and just kind of noticing that they were missing stuff, like really common things like farm animals and pets you hardly ever see in a natural history museum. And so it kind of occurred to me that the more that humans are involved, like the less likely you are to see them there, the less kind of natural they are. And then I got introduced to synthetic biology as a field by my friend Chris Voigt, who I think has been on your show.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of pointed to me that there was this whole realm of laboratory organisms and genetically engineered organisms that you never see on public display. And so it just seemed like there was this kind of blind spot that we needed to fill. And then it was just kind of a matter of time before I started collecting them.
Yeah. What are the rules for getting into your museum? What counts as post-natural?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, at some level, humans have influenced probably just about every living thing on the planet through, you know, climate change or pollution or what have you. So we've got to be more specific than that. So we chose to focus in on intentionality. The changes that we've made on purpose through breeding, domestication, genetic engineering. So it's the stuff we do on purpose that has kind of evolutionary consequence. It's inherited by the next generation.
Mm-hmm. You've got a picture of a gigantic pumpkin in your collection. We've actually done videos of gigantic people in Halloween contests are coming up, but they're like 2,000-pound pumpkins, right? Why a gigantic pumpkin?
These are one of the incredible post-natural wonders of our age, as far as I'm concerned. This really started as an American thing, but now it's worldwide. People growing pumpkins for size, and you know, every decade they just get bigger and bigger. And now we're crossing the 2,000-pound line. And these are grown only for size, not for feeding or anything like this. But all over the country, in fact, this very weekend, they're having giant pumpkin weigh-ins where they bring these things in on forklifts and they announce the genetic history of these pumpkins. They're not given any chemicals. They're not, you know, transgenic. They're just bred and fed. I mean, these pumpkins are nothing if not obese pumpkins.
Yes, I know. Flora Lichtman once did a video on these pumpkins. It was just really incredible. We heard a little bit about Freckles, your bio-steel goat. Why was Freckles created?
Well, Freckles is really special. She's a goat that was genetically engineered. And when I say that, I mean she has DNA from a completely different species in her DNA. She was genetically engineered to produce spider silk proteins in her milk. It turns out spider silk is some of the strongest stuff we know of. But the spiders themselves are kind of antisocial, so we can't farm them. They tend to eat each other. So the out-of-the-box thinking here was to use an animal that we already have kind of industrialized and get it to produce this spider silk in its milk. And that's what they're doing on this little research lab in Utah right now.
Mm-hmm. You only have one live specimen in the museum, and this is an aquarium of glowfish.
Yes.
What are glowfish? Yeah.
These are very charismatic. These are zebrafish mostly that have been given a gene from coral or jellyfish that make them fluoresce really brightly under black light, you know, just like your Led Zeppelin poster. And these are sold in pet shops all over the country, except in the state of California or any other country in the world, I might add. But these are the only genetically modified animal that you can legally take home with you. And they originated as laboratory organisms, but they're sold for purely aesthetic reasons today.
Mm-hmm. Talking with Rich Pell, founder of the Center for Post-Natural History on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. While we were at the museum taking a tour, we caught up with Matoshi from Delhi. He was visiting the museum last week, and we asked her whether the museum changed the way she thought about GMOs. And this was her response.
I mean, it's both ways. We definitely want to keep experimenting and finding out more of what is possible on this planet. But again, you know, who gives us the right to do this to other life forms? There was that flask with the human stem cells, which we figured out so that we're not hurting any humans while we experiment. But we don't apply the same standards to other life forms. So it's a bit still open to question.
Rich, what role do you think the center can play in controversial issues like GMOs?
Yeah, well, what we do is we're very careful not to present a position. What we want is for people to come in regardless of how they feel about these things and leave really wanting to know more. Like they learn a few things that they didn't know. They think about things a little bit differently. What we want is for people to be thinking harder. We're not trying to convince anyone that one idea is better than another. And it's really a big field we're talking about. I have to remember, we're talking about pet dogs in this, at the same time that we're talking about, you know, genetically modified corn. So it's too big an issue to have kind of one it's good or bad sort of answer to.
I hear that until recently you had a collection of transgenic mosquitoes.
Yes, that was actually the first collection we had. We collected genetically modified mosquitoes from the University of California, Irvine. And they were modified so that they couldn't have malaria. And it was a way of addressing the malaria issue in the wild. And I had pinned them myself, and they're preserved in a little box the way, you know, the way you do in a museum. And I went to look for them as I was preparing for a lecture, just to check a label. And I noticed that the labels were there, but the mosquitoes were gone. And when I lifted the lid up, I found this little wormy guy curled up in the corner. And I posted a picture of him to Facebook, and the woman, Lauren Allen, who would later become my wife and the co-director of the Center for Postnatural History, identified it as a dermestid beetle, which is the same thing that natural history collections use to clean the flesh off of the bones of their specimens. So in some ways, it kind of validated the collection at the same time as it destroyed it.
Honey,
we
he ate
him
the
Ringo,
mosquitoes.
By the way. Yeah.
would Dolly the sheep be considered post-natural? Is that a guess? Would you like to get? Where is Dolly? Stuffed somewhere?
Right. Yeah, Dolly is rotating on a platform in a museum of natural history in Edinburgh. She's actually kind of one of the few examples of what we would say is a post-natural organism in a natural history museum. She's kind of on like a disco stage. But yeah, she certainly would be, and not just for the reason that she was cloned. She was post-natural because she was domesticated, you know, so that we include that, you know, thousands of years of history into our notion of the post-natural, everything from the domestication of dogs and agriculture all the way forward. Mm. She's a particularly complicated case because of the cloning. But yes, absolutely, post-natural Dolly.
Mm. Would you like to see your museum become part of a traditional natural history museum one day?
I mean, at some level, of course, just because I've always wanted to inhabit one of those places. I always imagined, you know, the door with the gilded lettering saying, you know, Division of Postnatural History, you know, somewhere in the basement. But we also could equally exist in kind of any museum of culture, right? I mean, these are ultimately, we're looking at these living things that have been shaped by human desire. And they tell us all kinds of interesting things about us, not just about the organisms themselves. So we could be in a sports museum. We could be in an agricultural museum. We could be in an art museum.
How about a traveling exhibit? Any go around the country?
Yeah, we do. Actually, right now we have two traveling exhibits. They're both in Europe, unfortunately. We got to get one going in the U.S. In Barcelona and Berlin, you can see us.
Maybe you could pick up Dolly and bring it back while it's...
It would be nice to get Dolly on loan, sure.
Rich Pell is the director of the Center for Postnatural History in Pittsburgh. Thank you for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much, Ira.
And we have an audio slideshow from our museum tour at sciencefriday.com/postnatural. B.J. Lindemann composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. As always, if you like pictures, you love the pictures from Pluto. What about glamour shots of giant squid? You can guess the best science pictures sent to your inbox every Monday. Yes, you can get a new picture with our brand new newsletter, Picture of the Week. So sign up at sci-fry.me/picture-of-the-week. That's sci-fry.me/picture-of-the-week.